You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hi, and welcome to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I am Grant Goldberg, joined today by Spike Friedman. Spike, there's something really prominent in the news this morning. Former Seahawk legend Devin Hester retired, gives me PTSD about all the penalties and the Falcons game in the playoffs, the Kevin Pierre-Lewis hold, and all the other good stuff. So salute to Devin Hester, one of the game's best returners to ever do it. Spike, do you have any passionate feelings about Devin Hester?
He's real good. I don't know. Is he a Hall of Famer? I don't know. But sure, why not? Or no, I don't know. Do you get to be his returner? That's another Seahawks Hall of Famer from the Pete Carroll era.
Right. John Schneider, always making moves, always acquiring Hall of Fame talent.
Yeah. Kevin Williams is another one of those. Dwight Freeney.
Everybody running through Seattle might get mentioned in Canton one day. Who knows? So today's show, we're gonna go over some things about the Seahawks injuries, the Rams injuries, and going over the fallout from the activities in the Jaguars game at the end of the fourth quarter. But we'll start it off. Bobby Wagner is a game time decision on Sunday, which is arguably the biggest thing for the Seahawks going into the game, given that there aren't any suspensions from the Jaguars game. Spike, I know the Seahawks can win against the Rams without Bobby, but how huge is having Bobby on the field against the Rams and Todd Gurley?
It's really big. We saw what the Rams can do against the Seahawks when everything is working. But I will say this. The most important level of the defense against the Rams is not the linebackers. As much as Todd Gurley is a massive weapon for them in the passing game and the running game, I don't think, and as much like, I don't think Bobby Wagner is as crucial in this game as he has been in others. I think this game is going to come down to the defensive line, how much pressure we get on Jared Goff. We saw in the first game against the Rams that when we didn't pressure Jared Goff, they drove the field pretty easily. Now they missed a field goal, dropped a touchdown pass, and fumbled on the goal line. So scoreline didn't look like they were able to drive easily, but they were. When the line wasn't getting home, when the line was getting home, they turned the ball over, I believe, three times on offense and then another time on special teams. So for me, as much as Wagner matters in terms of denying explosive runs, and as much as explosive runs will drive us crazy if Wagner doesn't play, which it seems like it's the most likely outcome, in terms of winning the game or not, in terms of turnovers, in terms of real turnarounds, I think it's going to be more important that the defensive linemen weren't suspended than Wagner's presence in this game. Though that's just looking for a silver lining on a dark, gloomy cloud of losing the arguable defensive player of the year.
Yeah, he's been so sensational this year, and you see the immediate impact when he left the game. There's a lot of circumstance in the Jaguars game, but they had three touchdowns and three scrimmage plays without Bobby Wagner on the field. That speaks to something.
I will say we don't have Cam Chancellor either, and as good as Bradley McDougal has been in coverage and in that second level, I don't think he can be the sort of run stuffer in the box that Cam Chancellor was, which means that Bobby Wagner's absence will be more palpable, which I think is what we saw when Leonard Fournette was able to get that big run to ice the game in Jacksonville. Man, if Bobby Wagner and Cam Chancellor are on the field, we get another bite at the apple even after that bad holding non-call.
Even KJ Wright, too, having him on the field is going to be huge, and he has to go through the concussion protocol. And so possibly with being without the two best linebackers that the Seahawks have, arguably the best duo in the league, it would be noticeable going into the game. So we'll wait for some updates for that. But Bobby Wagner's been so dominant in every phase of the game on defense. So when you miss a player of his caliber, you're going to feel the difference. And what you said about no suspensions on the defensive line, that's huge going into this game, because arguably the Rams' best offensive lineman, Andrew Whitworth, is dealing with a high ankle sprain. He's probably going to play, but you know, him not being at 100% definitely bodes well for the Seahawks and their pass rush that, you know, really needs to get home on Jared Goff to make this game difficult for the Rams, because we've seen if he gets time, you know, he's that quarterback that the Rams thought he'd be drafted number one overall. He, you know, has the time to make the decisions, go through his reads, and even spring a run for a first down, as we saw in the matchup earlier in the year with the Rams. So, you know, if there's one thing they can't afford on top of losing Bobby Wagner, it's giving Jared Goff that time. So the pass rush really needs to get home this week.
Yeah, and we saw that over the course of that first game, we were able to sort of wear down that Rams line and get there. But Frank Clark had that huge strip sack that, you know, changed the game. That was the most important play of the game. That said, otherwise, he had zero pressures going against Andrew Whitworth. So if Whitworth is not 100%, that makes a big difference. We've seen with Dwayne Brown not being 100% on his ankle, he's still such a massive upgrade over Reece Odhiambo that you'd expect something similar, that if Whitworth is able to play at all, he's better than whoever the Rams are going to pull up off the practice squad. But if he's 80, 90% of himself, changes the game. Because again, Goff with time is a really good quarterback now, which is horrifying and like shocking to say after his last season. Goff without time is not the catastrophe he was in the Jeff Fisher era, but he's not very good. He is not Russell Wilson under pressure. He's not Tom Brady under pressure. He can't move the pocket. His ability to progress through his reads when things get complicated is pretty limited. When he knows exactly how to work through his progression, he can find that guy. When you put a hand in his face and make it hard for him, he turns the ball over. And so and we're going to need some turnovers, I think. As much improved as our offensive line is, it's still a really tough matchup against a Rams defense that's coalesced over the last few weeks.
Right. We saw in the Jacksonville game, you know, if the Seahawks were able to, you know, get some takeaways, that game is a lot different. Yeah. And going up against the Rams, especially with a defense that's not the same in the first matchup, you know, getting those balls bouncing your way like they did in the first matchup would be huge. And it definitely helped the Seahawks in winning the game. I don't think that goes without saying.
Like the word luck gets thrown around maybe too much when you talk football, but we were pretty lucky in that Rams game. Zuerlein doesn't miss a lot of field goals. He's not a Blair Walsh type in that way. And he missed a relatively easy one.
Right.
And the fumble bounces came our way throughout, which doesn't always happen. So, you know, I don't think we're going to necessarily need luck again because of our offensive line. And our ability, I mean, you saw it against the Jaguars. Like, if we had played the Jaguars week 5, Russell Wilson would have been dead. Instead, he was throwing into traffic. Their coverage is great. The Rams' coverage is nowhere near the Jaguars' coverage, even if their defensive lines are comparably good. Tremaine Johnson is dealing with a stinger, so he's questionable. He'll probably play this week, but as we've seen with stingers, you never know. And they lost Kayvon Webster, who's been really good for them, to a torn Achilles. So their secondary is depleted, and their safety play has been really up and down this year. It was actually pretty good against the Seahawks the first time we played, but it was really bad against the Eagles, against both Carson Wentz and Nick Foles. So there's reason to have hope that the Seahawks will be able to be more effective on offense against this Rams team than they have been against the Rams in a couple of years.
Yeah, I feel a lot more confident, one, because it's at home, and two, because of the transformation that the offensive line has undergone.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking at the matchup of Russell Wilson and the Seahawks receivers going up against the Rams secondary, especially, you know, given the injuries that they have, and I feel a lot more comfortable winning this game as compared to, you know, the first matchup this year, you know, we're kind of banking on the defense to stop Gurley and put pressure on Goff and just give the offense enough chances to win the game. And so I feel more confident as a whole, and I know that probably more points are going to be scored in this game than last game. And, you know, I feel confident in the Seahawks' ability to, you know, outscore the Rams given the given Russell Wilson's caliber of play over the course of the season. And just I don't trust Jared Goff to put enough points on the board against a Seahawks defense that's missing some key pieces.
It's
but
missing
still,
so many pieces, man. But it could still, go. This game, I mean, could be, like this game. You're right. Like you're totally right. But I did just have like a flash in my head that this game could be like their game against the Eagles this last week, and like somehow end up 38-35.
Our game against the Texans.
Exactly. Like that could 100% be in play. I mean, I'm just picturing Byron Maxwell in trail coverage against Robert Woods. You know, I'm just picturing, and then on the other side, Doug Baldwin against not Kayvon Webster, whoever they have to dredge up off their practice squad. Like, oh boy, like, and Doug Baldwin primed for a bounce back game after one of the worst games of his career. Right. I'm like, both ways, there could be a lot of explosive plays in the passing game.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're in for a shootout, possibly. And we'll go over the rest of the matchups and all the other Seahawks news right after this. We are back with Locked On Seahawks. And Spike, as we mentioned earlier on the show, there will not be any suspensions stemming from the post-play activities late in the fourth quarter in the Jacksonville Jaguars game, which is really big. You know, the Seahawks were, you know, possibly going to be without Sheldon Richardson, going to be without Quentin Jefferson, but that's not the case. And you know, you see Quentin Jefferson's explanation. You know, he's gotten food thrown at him. There's heavy speculation that, you know, racial slurs were involved. And you know, I'll say this: it's definitely easier said than done to keep your composure when something like that happens. I'm not advocating for him to jump in the stands at all. By no means should he have tried to do that. But what I'm saying is, I'm seeing where he's coming from, and I see the reasoning behind it. It's easy for me to say he should have just walked away, being behind a computer screen and my microphone, because A, I'm not a professional athlete. B, I've never been in a situation like that. So it's a lot easier for me to say not being in that kind of situation.
Well, I think that there are three separate things that happened in that aftermath. There's Michael Bennett going for the strip, but also, you know, blowing up a victory formation, which even if he didn't dive at the offensive lineman's knees specifically, that's the sort of play that's always going to get the other team fired up, like always. There's a reason why you don't do that. There's a reason why that has such a negative reputation. There's a reason why that sort of play tarnished Greg Schiano's reputation, in addition to everything else he's done and maybe done. I mean, that's okay. That's a totally other story. But with Michael Bennett, like, this is his third time doing it, and it pisses off opponents because knees get blown out when that happens. And even if he doesn't put his helmet on their knee, it still is the sort of thing that when it happens to you as an offensive lineman, you're like, oh man, my knee could blow out right now.
Especially
on a play
like
that doesn't matter.
With all his weight behind it, too, even if it's
exactly.
Not the helmet leading.
Because you're not bracing for it. And yes, on the one hand, an offensive lineman should always be bracing for it. On the other hand, like, be sportsmanlike. The game's over.
Right.
So that's one thing. But that is not in and of itself suspendable. Then you look at Sheldon Richardson, who got ejected for throwing a punch. But if you look, it's an open-handed slap, just sort of like wildly, that doesn't connect. So that's, and it wasn't like a fight. So you don't expect that to be suspended either. And then with the Jefferson thing, moving towards the fans in the way he did would normally be a suspension. But given the heavy speculation that there was racial abuse involved, that is a mitigating factor, given that he didn't get into the crowd, given that he was able to calm down before that happened. So in all three cases, it was like a borderline situation, but you can see why none of them crossed that line into a suspendable offense, even though they are all in their own different ways worthy of penalties and like kind of a bummer that happened to the Seahawks, because like it's not something you want your team to be doing in any of those three situations, but they are all like, again, like, there's all this talk of like, oh, is this, you know, this is beyond embarrassing. It's like, no, this is just bad. Like, it's ugly stuff. Like,
it's what happens in football sometimes too.
Yeah, you look at that Steelers-Bengals game that happened 2 weeks ago, and you're like, man, there were a lot of plays. Like, JoJo Smith-Schuster, you know, crack blocking a guy on the backside and then, you know, taunt. It's like, if I were a Steelers fan, I wouldn't like write off JoJo Smith-Schuster. I would be like, oh boy, not great, not what you should be doing. Right. But also, not the sort of thing that where you write a guy off forever. Vontaze Burfict, maybe. Like, if Vontaze Burfict were on our team, I'd be like, oh, God, can we not anymore?
Right.
But, like, there's a limited number of guys, given how brutal football is by default, where I need to have that much moral hand-wringing. We can say something is bad without castigating the person who does the bad thing.
We don't have to condemn the person just because of one action.
That action is like, what is they, you know, they did something awful off the field. Like, right. We need to have scale for these things. Like, Sheldon Richardson slapping a dude is not the, like, honestly, of everyone on our defense, the only person who I feel at all negative about, like, in the broad scheme of things, is Frank Clark.
Exactly.
You know? Like, that, and that's a different conversation, but, like, that's the sort, like, nothing that happened between the three dudes on the field has anything like the other side, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying, and say if Frank Clark had gotten into stuff, like, there's, you can build on top of that conversation with the off-field, what happened off-field, and I think that, you know, even Quentin Jefferson was calming down, you see him moving towards the stands, and he moves away, and then he gets hit by a piece of food. Like, then it re-escalates the situation. And, you know,
And I saw on Twitter that it was a banana. You know, I'm not going to zap Reader Phil. That situation. Sorry, that was a weird hiccup, I just did.
It's bad on all fronts. From the fans' front, obviously, from, you know, Jefferson, it's not a good look at all. But, like you said, he didn't get into the stands. You know, it didn't escalate any further than that. And Michael Bennett, you know, given his reputation, off the field, you know he's not like doing it maliciously, and he's even spoken out against, you know, people diving at people's knees, and it's kind of just weird to see him go back on that.
It's disappointing and it's a bummer, but it's not like I'm gonna change how I feel about Michael Bennett because
it doesn't alter your perception. One bad football play doesn't alter a perception of a person in the whole. I think that, you know, if we look back at the game, you know, all game it was kind of heated. We saw Jermaine Ifedi get into it with a couple Jacksonville Jaguars defensive linemen. And so, you know, when you get into a game like that where it's so physical and the teams mirror each other so heavily, you know, there's bound to be tensions rising. And, and I just think that, you know, it was kind of all a perfect storm and the fashion that it all happened. I'm just glad it didn't escalate any further.
Yeah, I agree.
And so after this, we'll get into why Russell Wilson's MVP case might not be dead yet.
Oh, my God. Stay tuned, baby. Guys, this is crucial. I want to be – you know, we're going to say something awesome also after the – we're not just going to rehash the MVP debate. We're going to do one more awesome thing, so you better stick around.
We are back, and Spike, you know, we touched on this last week, and we kind of tried to close the door on this argument. We thought going into Monday Night Football against the Dolphins, Tom Brady would separate himself even more in the MVP race from Russell Wilson and from a now injured Carson Wentz. But that's not the case.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but condolences to Philadelphia fans.
Yes, like, exactly.
For that to be how this season gets derailed, probably. I mean, Nick Foles is good. That team is deep. We saw that they can play in all phases of the game. But we also saw against Seattle that they are not necessarily equipped to win a shootout on the road, although they did just win a shootout on the road in LA, so who knows? But, like, man, does it feel unlikely without Wentz for them to be able to make the run. And then with an ACL tear for Wentz, he's going to have to rush back to make it back at the beginning of next year, which means he's likely to not be mobile. And we saw how much of his value comes from his running, and so for him to lose his mobility in his third season, it's just like such a bummer.
Right.
It's
such a bad year in terms of injuries for the NFL.
And I feel like because Carson Wentz is like a white quarterback with a big arm, we don't think about how important his mobility is to his game. But it's like Russell Wilson being injured. And we saw what it was like with Russell Wilson injured last year. And that's going to be Carson Wentz next year, and that he's probably going to have to wear a knee brace, which means he's going to be moving at 2/3 speed, which is going to change Carson Wentz. And, you know, he's been so good, and I think his arm skills are strong enough that in the long run it might benefit him to, like, spend a year forced to sit in the pocket. I think you could make the argument that it will have benefited Russell Wilson in the long term to have had to suffer through last year, A, to know what it's like to play through injuries, and B, to, like, sharpen up a little bit playing from the excuse for a pocket that the terrible Seahawks offensive line provided. But, you know, at the same time, you don't want to see a season sort of wasted or lost. And with Wentz, that's potentially true next year by how late this injury happened this year.
I feel like on top of that, to build on top of your point, if there's a, you know, the Eagles offensive line is really good, especially at full strength. And so they can give Carson Wentz that kind of pocket to where he can develop that kind of skill. And he's just an awesome player. There's no other way to go about it. You know, we see all these plays that he makes with his legs, keeping the play alive, and, you know, looking downfield and throwing it 45 yards downfield with someone dragging him down. You know, that's a special kind of player, and it sucks to see him go down. And I'm assuming partial blame, because all season I've been saying, you know, something's going to happen to the Eagles to ruin their season. And I feel kind of bad for saying that, because given the Carson Wentz ACL tear, but at the same time, you know, I feel bad for the Eagles. And
no, man, no one is anywhere near full strength right now. Like,
it's wide open.
Wild. It is wild how decimated the whole league is. I mean, the team that's closest to full strength is probably Jacksonville right now. And they have Blake Bortles at quarterback. And as much as he played fine against the Seahawks, if that's your version of full strength, yeesh. I mean, and weirdly, the other team is the Chargers. How are the Chargers there? Like, the Chargers and the Jaguars are arguably the strongest teams in the league right now relative to sort of their baseline. I mean, you look at you look around the league and you've got key players down for every team now. I mean, the Rams are healthier than most, but losing Kayvon Webster is a big deal. I mean, it would be like the Seahawks losing Shaq Griffin, and, you know, that's a big deal. Like,
yeah, we see the Vikings still, you know, Teddy Bridgewater's sideline still. I mean, he's healthy. We see Dalvin Cook go down.
They're on their third string quarterback and running back. Like, as much as, like, a lot of their team is healthy and as well as Case Keenum is playing, like, they're still on their third stringer at multiple positions.
Yeah, it's you know, we've seen a lot of parity in the NFL this year, and it's because of how injury prone every team is. And we've seen, you know, just, you know, every team kind of beating each other. We see the Seahawks beat the Eagles. We see the Eagles beat the Rams. We see, you know, everybody's beating each other.
Yeah, and I will say that the other, I mean, like, we've gotten off track here because
we need to reel it back in.
Yeah, but I just want to say, like, Ryan Shazier's injury, because it was so shocking in its form, I don't think we fully took into account what it means for that Pittsburgh defense. It was sort of out of nowhere great this year, but then you look at them without Shazier, and it's sort of like the Seahawks without Bobby Wagner. Like, he's that good in the middle of the field, and they don't have the talent or the system around him to sort of compensate for his absence.
He makes that kind of impact. I wouldn't say he's as good, but he makes a Bobby Wagner type impact for that defense.
Yeah. And he's just so fast.
He's so fast. And he covers so much ground.
Yeah. He can just do some things Yes. He's not. What I'll say is this: his highs are maybe even slightly higher than Bobby Wagner's. He's nowhere near as consistent a tackler as Bobby Wagner, or is like steady a force in the middle of the field. But his athleticism, his skill set is as close to Bobby Wagner as anybody not named Luke Kuechly.
I think that if Bobby Wagner had Ryan Shazier's athleticism, we'd possibly see like someone die on the field. Which is a good thing that he doesn't have that.
Although Bobby Wagner's athleticism, he's real fast.
Like, yeah, he's super fast,
like,
too.
He's only like 4% faster, like, with Shazier. Anyway, okay, so that's all. We had to do that little quick run through of the league. So wait, what are we going to talk about?
So going into Monday Night Football, we thought that Russell Wilson's case for MVP was kind of dwindling down. Tom Brady was supposed to separate himself, but he didn't. They laid an egg against the Miami Dolphins. The Patriots lost. Carson Wentz went down, like we said. And so, you know, that 3-touchdown, 3-interception performance, you know, when you really look at it, isn't as terrible as it reads. And, like, game script is certainly a thing with it. And Russell Wilson still, his MVP argument still has legs.
Yeah. Ben Baldwin's been making this point. We always talk about Ben Baldwin because he's a good stat guy and he's a good counterintuitive stat guy. But, like, Wilson's game adjusted for the caliber of the Jaguars' defense was actually really good.
It was one of the best performances against the Jaguars all season.
Yeah, his adjusted QBR for opponent was, I think, 71, which isn't great. And, like, obviously, through three quarters, it was still bad. But to do what he did in the fourth quarter against that defense is reminiscent of what, I mean, not to go to the dark place, but what Matt Ryan did against the Seahawks in the playoffs when they knocked us out. You know, like, that is a really great pass defense, a pass defense that is only eclipsed by the 2013 Seahawks. Their pass defense is better than the 2014 Seahawks. So it's only eclipsed by the 2013 Seahawks and the 2002 Buccaneers in this century. So, like, they're really good, and Russ carved them up and would have had more if not for some weird calls and drops down the stretch. Like, he played great for – and, yes, it was only one quarter, but when you're up against a defense like that – popping off to the level that he did for even one quarter is staggering. Really impressive.
Yeah.
Tom Brady played real bad. And the Dolphins' defense is not terrible by any means. They're not garbage, but it's not the Jaguars. And he played real bad and really didn't give his chance a team to win down the stretch, which is, you know, kind of shocking.
When you look at Brady's numbers without Gronk and without Edelman, it's completely different, and he plays like a different quarterback, and the offense looks lost at times. You look at that, you know, given the kind of caliber of player that Tom Brady is, obviously, you know, he's, you know, one of the greatest ever, arguably the greatest ever, but, you know, in 2017, without his top two weapons, you know, I wouldn't say he's like every other league quarterback, but it's definitely a noticeable drop-off.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the quarterbacks who played the best this year, and they are Deshaun Watson, Carson Wentz, Aaron Rodgers, and none of them have played enough games to win the MVP. I mean, maybe Carson Wentz. Maybe Carson Wentz has. Maybe I don't think he can give it to Aaron Rodgers, even if he comes back and wins out. Like, I don't think he can do that. And then, the Deshaun Watson thing is such a bummer. And then you got a dog pile with, like, Case Keenum at the top on the numbers. But, like, I don't buy that. I can't get there with Case Keenum for MVP. But, like, he's the next best candidate behind Brady and Wilson. Like, that's crazy town. I mean, Roethlisberger had some terrible games this year. You saw what he did against the Jaguars. My God. He had, what, five interceptions?
Five interceptions.
Like, gee whiz. And then, I mean, and now he's throwing up stats again, but, like, and I saw the argument, actually, and it's like, maybe this is the year you give it to an Antonio Brown, because he's been phenomenal.
Yeah, and you look at all the seasons, and it's nothing new that he's doing. He's just that great consistently, and, you know, he's definitely an MVP-caliber player. It's just, it's a quarterback's award.
Yeah. Yeah, but, like, you know, some years a quarterback doesn't do it, and, like, I think we might be at that point in the conversation where we've got to bring in some of those other guys. And, like, Brown's been really good.
Well, we see skill position players win it traditionally when there's record-breaking seasons. And so, yeah, like,
can Antonio Brown get there? What are his stats exactly?
All right, we'll have to pull up his stats, you know, during the show. But, like I said, I mean, you see LaDainian Tomlinson, Sean Alexander. Like, those were record-breaking seasons, and, you know, it doesn't deviate from that much, and a quarterback usually wins the award.
Okay, yeah,
so we're pulling up his stats right now, and he's already at 1,500 receiving yards, almost 100 receptions. He's at 1,509 receptions, yeah, nope. 9 TDs.
The record on yardage is 1964, set by Calvin Johnson in 2012. But obviously that Lions team wasn't great, and I feel like Aaron Rodgers had a great year that year or something. Julio at 1,871 2 years ago. I mean, if he gets to 1,800, which seems like he will, right? They got three games left,
and, you know, he's had games of 182 yards, 157, 155, 169.
His last three games, he has 492 yards. If he got what he – or no, 482 yards. So he would be just ahead of the record. If he puts up similar numbers to what he did over the last three games, over the next three games, he will break the receiving yard record. Now, that would be incredible, obviously, for him to do that, especially against the Patriots next week, who have a revived offense. But, like, if he does that, I think you got to put – if he breaks the record – because that Steelers team is going to go something like 13-3. If he breaks the receiving yard record this year, I think he's the guy. But that'll require an epic run, you know? And if Wilson wins out against defenses as good as the Rams and the Cardinals, who were very quietly very good since Buda Baker came in at safety, I think he's got a great case. I think it's – and I think if Brady wins out, including beating that Steelers team, I think he'll have a great case. And if and honestly, if Case Keenum wins out, like, that'll be a great case. Because, like – so I think, weirdly, those are your guys. And, like, it just is going to come down to who wins out right now.
Right, and you see Antonio Brown. He can go off for 200 yards. He can score 3 touchdowns in a game. So it's really, you know, any given time he steps on the football field, something great can happen.
Yeah, he only has 9 touchdowns this year. So if he were to do what he did over the last 3 games, he'd end with 12. If he ended up with 1,980 yards and 12 touchdowns, would that be enough? I think it is, but, like,
it
I don't know.
It certainly should be.
It'll certainly be in the conversation given how bad the combination of quarterback play and injuries has been this year. There is no Matt Ryan. There's no guy out there breaking records. Drew Brees is not Drew Brees. He's very good, but that Saints team doesn't revolve around him
Yeah, you see him relying on the running game. And to go back to Russell Wilson at this point, you know, these are going to be tough games. He's obviously facing the Rams. And he's going to have to score a lot of points against the Cowboys offense, who are getting back Ezekiel Elliott.
Oh, it's so annoying that we have to play Zeke. It's so annoying.
It is. Oh. And then, like you said, the Cardinals' defense has been great over the past few weeks. And so, I mean, Blaine Gabbert's that quarterback, but Russell Wilson's not playing Blaine Gabbert. He's playing the Cardinals' defense. And, you know, I think that if Russell Wilson wins out, and he does so impressively...
Yeah,
and obviously Tom Brady's going to need to slip up a little bit more. We could see Russell Wilson win MVP, and like
he's
obviously,
still, I think he's the second favorite by the numbers right now. Although I bet, because I feel like I literally, as we were having this conversation, Robert Mays just tweeted out, "There's an argument for Antonio Brown for MVP." I feel like the MVP talk it is going to shift towards Antonio Brown this week, and it'll be up to him to go big against the Patriots and sort of coalesce that campaign or not. This is all dumb. Like, they just got to win that game. But we'll see. We want to talk 2 more quick things before wrapping up today. The first one, the fun thing I promised. You guys got to watch, from Earl Thomas's perspective, all the fracas at the end of that Jaguars game. He just stands there with his hands on his hips like a disappointed father. And I just want to give shout-outs to how awesome and amazing Earl Thomas is. We saw what happened in the Seahawks defense without him last year. Now he's, like, the only healthy starter left. And they are somehow just as good. They're better than they were just losing Earl Thomas last year with just Earl Thomas left. They're not much better, but they're better. So shouts to Earl Thomas for being the coolest dad in football.
I've seen that look many times from my own dad. And so, like, I felt that with Earl Thomas. He was just looking at his teammates like, really, guys? Like, come on. Like, I'm not mad at you, but I'm disappointed. And then, like, you see he's like the glue that holds the Seahawks team together, along with Bobby Wagner, but... It reminds me of, I know I mentioned superhero movies a lot on this podcast, but I think it was Captain America Civil War when Captain America's holding a helicopter with one hand, he's holding the launching pad with another, and like holding the two together with just the strength of his arms and whole body. And I feel like that's what Earl Thomas does, or at least it's comparable from a football standpoint.
I agree.
And so the second thing that we have for you guys, we're gonna go back into the Seahawks history, and this is the December 12th show of the Locked On Seahawks podcast. So we ventured back, we looked back to December 12th, 1982. The Seahawks played the Chicago Bears and won 20-14. And so we'll go over the stats. Steve Largent had 8 receptions for 111 yards. Jim Zorn rushed for a 15-yard touchdown. Norm Johnson made 2 field goals. Interestingly enough, Walter Payton threw a touchdown pass, earning the title of the game's highest-rated passer. And it's kind of funny because you look at the Seahawks now and you see some stats, but you look at the Seahawks in 1982, the Seahawks were outgained, they had less first downs, but they won the turnover battle 2-0, and they lost the penalty battle, but they are able to do enough to win the game.
Yeah. I good job, Seahawks of the past.
Right. We talked about this off air a little bit, but the Seahawks were not terrible. Like, going into their history, you know, they definitely had a lot more high peaks and low valleys than your average Seattle sports team.
Yeah. I think that unlike the Sonics, who had great peaks and now no longer exist, and the Mariners, who had one peak that sort of, if you look closely, had some ripples in it, but have otherwise been one of the most disappointing franchises in any sport in the history of sports. Seahawks have been just, like, pretty good for the bulk of their tenure in the league, which is cool and nice, and I like it. That's all. That's
yeah,
all I get.
I think that also the uniforms in that game are underrated, and I can't wait to see the day where they wear them on field with Nike. And that'll be glorious. I think that's something to look forward to, and it's something to end the podcast on. So
yeah,
you know what happens when we get to the end of the show. You got to go to iTunes. You got to leave a 5-star review. Leave your Twitter handle in it, and enter yourself to win a Pro Football Focus Edge membership. And then you can go on draft.com and play in leagues, and you can use a promo code LONFL. You can get a full return on your first deposit for draft.com. It's 3 minutes you're spending drafting a team of all-stars, so you're giving yourself a shot to win. There's a good chance you win. There's a good chance you get hooked. You know, I've said that Spike is dealing with some issues. I know he was down last time he played, but yeah. I think he's looking to bounce back.
Oh, you gotta bounce back.
And so I think that we can look forward to the Seahawks playing the Rams on Sunday. And it's definitely a favorable matchup for the offense's perspective, given their bolstered offensive line and the matchup against this Rams secondary. So you can look forward to that. You can look forward to Russell Wilson possibly having a game to give him a step further in the MVP race. So for Locked On Seahawks and optimism, I'm Grant Goldberg signing off.
And I'm Spike Friedman, also signing off.